Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:53 in that specific summer time. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And I think we can't really just kick off into the long term until we consider what's been happening this week, because it's been such a volatile environment overall. Obviously, this week, if one looks at the charts, then this week was not nearly as volatile as the week before. But we have not had the kind of emphatic upward dynamics this week that would have instilled a great deal of confidence. And perhaps the most important factor here is that volatility is holding at what is a high level, particularly relative to what we've seen over the last 3 years. The volatility was incredibly inert, and now it's popped to the upside. Well, this has engendered a great deal of discussion and among pundits, and I've seen some people compare this situation to 2008, others to 2011, and I can see there's parallels, because one is that 2011 was a somewhat larger pullback in the context of what turned out to be a very powerful medium-term uptrend, and that would be latched onto those who wish to see the market find support quickly and then start pushing back up towards the end of the year. 2008 is a bit of a stretch if you're going to make a comparison. Certainly we've had a pullback, and we've had the index move, the majority of indices pull back below their respective 200-day moving averages. But I really think that's where the parallels are begin to become stretched after that point. We certainly don't have the same degree of leverage in the financial sector that we had then. But that's not to say that that quantitative easing hasn't had a distorting effect, because obviously it has had a distorting effect. But then what could be a possible parallel for what we've seen over the last 2 weeks? And I think that it is the flash crash of 2010, May 6, 2010. Certainly, there was some type of flash crash in a number of ETFs where their net asset values couldn't be priced quick enough to respond to the market, and they just went to extraordinarily low levels for a very short period of time. Well, that is really quite damaging to sentiment, and that's why it's a parallel to 2011, because what happened after the flash crash? Well, we had an emphatic bounce, and we did have a good bounce after the events on August 24th. But it was damaging to sentiment. So what people started to think about was, well, what happens if it happens again? What would I do? And people think, oh, well, stops didn't help me very much the last time around, so I know what I'm going to do the next time. I'm going to take my profits when I see them. And we're starting to see a little bit of that, where the market sentiment has been damaged, and there is a fixation now about what is the correct thing to do with stops. And that's not a particularly good thing. That means then that if people are worried about stops, and the lesson that they have learned has been that they should take short-term profits, well, then the likelihood of people increasing their positions in an aggressive fashion decreases. And for algorithmic trading systems, their ability to increase positions would be contingent on volatility metrics coming back down. You can write a program to buy and sell securities in any way, shape, or form that one might wish, but if you have to tell the computer how much to buy or sell, that has got to be dictated by the size of individual positions relative to the capital available and the volatility of those positions in order to manage risk. Well, the volatility then has to be measured on a single stock basis, and that's really quite high, and on an average of the index, which is now at at levels that really haven't been seen for a while. So we're definitely in a more volatile environment, and it means that position sizes for algorithmic trading systems are necessarily lower. And you start to add that in to some of the commentary and speculation about exactly when the Fed might raise interest rates, and then this is probably much more like 2010 than we've seen in the 5 years since then. And what happened was that you had a good bounce, and then markets traded lower and moved to a new low, but not a significant new low, over the coming month, and built support over the next 2 months before then regrouping and starting to go back up again. And I suspect that that is probably the closest parallel, that this is now looking increasingly like a first step above this incredibly long range that persisted on the S&P for 13 years between 2000 and 2013, for the FTSE 100, where the index has been ranging since 2000 and hasn't actually broken up yet, and that this is looking increasingly like a large range, and a range within a range, in that this could quite likely be a consolidation in the upper side of the long-term range before the index eventually breaks out. The DAX broke out and has pulled back to the region of 10,000, and that's a big psychological level. Well, European shares aren't as highly valued as US shares. They're still trading at a reasonable discount, but there's an inverse correlation between European shares and the euro. And the euro surged higher on August 24th, not least due to deleveraging. And that's part of the distorting influence that quantitative easing has, that we are presented with these environments where central banks are printing money with abandon, and that money will flow to the most attractive assets. Well, leveraged traders will borrow money for nothing and invest it where they think they can get a better return, capital appreciation and currency appreciation. Well, it's easy to borrow in euros and invest in euros because you take out your currency risk, but you don't take out your market risk. And if the market starts to turn down and people start to trade out of their positions, then those short euro positions necessarily have to get closed, and that puts a bid under the price. Well, we saw the euro rally, but it didn't support the move above 115. And there are good reasons beyond the carry trade why the euro should be weak. The ECB is, after all, printing 60 billion euros a month. The Bank of Japan is still in an easing mode. And the Bank of China is also printing money in here. Well, what we are, though, seeing is that the People's Bank of China, having now abandoned its peg, that the spread between the onshore and the offshore renminbi is starting to widen out. Now, we're only talking about a couple of basis points here. This isn't a wide variance, but it's not getting thinner, it's getting wider. That suggests that foreign investors are taking money out of China. Now, the stock market was closed the last 2 days, and it will be interesting to see what happens with it on Monday. But we've seen an awful lot of bad news priced in, and this index is really quite oversold on the downside. So it's not beyond the bounds possibility that we're in the region of a low. And the banking sector has rallied enough over the last six sessions that we could perhaps be in the region of a low, and that it has room now to consolidate above that low. China joining the competitive devaluation circle puts pressure on its neighbors. And the Indonesian rupiah, for example, has been falling for 3 years. The Malaysian ringgit is in a downtrend. The Philippine peso, which had been a stalwart among currencies in the region, well, broke down earlier this year. And they need to preserve their competitiveness relative to regional heavyweights like China and Japan. That's really who they compete with for their business. This, then, if we think about what are the threats to a secular bull market, well, we do not have surging oil prices. That's absolutely there's no prospect of that. We have rather the opposite, that oil prices are quite weak. That Brent crude had an upside weekly key reversal from the region of $40 last week and finished pretty much flat this week, but held on to the majority of its bounce last week. So there is prospect for, you know, short-term bounce and a reversion back to the mean. And, you know, an industrial metal like nickel is back at the psychological 10,000 and then marked the region of the 2008 peak. It also marked the upper side of the long-term base that it broke out of in 2002. So this is an area of potential support, and it also bounced last week. So there is the prospect here that, you know, commodities have gone down enough, that emerging market currencies have been so incredibly weak that competitiveness is rapidly being corrected in here. Well, there isn't a great deal of evidence yet to say that they're not going to get even more competitive, but we are starting to see tentative signs that the commonality in the deterioration of emerging market currencies is stopping. You can see that if by clicking through the currency sections of the chart library, you'll see, for example, that Colombian peso has at least stopped going down. That you're starting to see that outside of the total reliance on commodities for emerging markets, that some of those currencies are starting to stabilize a bit. And that's reasonably good news. When we think about it just from the long-term perspective, that it's not at all impossible that following a very lengthy range and an impressive breakout, that you go through a period of consolidation where people really ask the question, has anything really changed? Is this now a new secular bull market, or are we going to be in an unimpressive economic expansion, potentially indefinitely? And I think that's probably the big question that will be asked. And if we're correct in the view that this is a secular bull market, that this is a first step above the base, that higher levels will be sustained beyond the short term, or I guess they broke out 2 years, 3 years ago, beyond the medium term, that the lows of any major reaction are likely to represent the upper side of the underlying range. That is it possible following a breakout for any kind of instrument to come back and test the upper side of the underlying range? And you have to answer that it absolutely is possible. Well, the upper side of the S&P range is around 1550 to 1600. And that would represent a 20% pullback. And if you think that that sentiment was bearish last week when we had a 7 to 8% pullback in the space of a few days, then consider just how bearish it would be if we pulled back further. There's a great deal of uncertainty, and of course there's uncertainty when you're in a corrective phase. That's why you have a corrective phase. But there are some very significant bullish factors, that energy prices are coming down, and obviously that's not good news if you're a producer, but it is wonderful news if you're a consumer. And that's just incredibly bullish, that every $10 hike in the price of oil represents a 0.1% headwind to GDP. Well, oil prices have fallen nearly $100 in the last year. So that represents a medium-term tailwind to growth. And it takes a little bit of time for that to start filtering through. But consumers start to feel that they have additional money in their pocket. And of course, having been through a traumatic event like two burst bubbles in a decade, then people obviously start by paying down their debt. But as they become more secure and as lower prices persist for longer, and we enter what has the potential to be an abundant energy environment, where not only is oil both cheap and abundant, but that natural gas is cheap and abundant, and solar technology and wind technology improve to the point where they're truly competitive. It then means that the potential for battery technology to complement renewables means that they could finally start to meet base load requirements. And that would be transformative from an energy perspective. And it could potentially mean that oil prices will range probably above $40, but below $80 well into the medium term. And I guess from the perspective of someone who is looking to trade the market, well, then prices right now are cheap. And the energy sector generally is incredibly beaten down. And when one is looking for absolute value in a stock market and people looking to buy the dips, well, then the resources sector right now is incredibly depressed. And obviously depressed because you have this stress in the emerging markets. Well, since emerging markets, and particularly China, represented the really big growth story in terms of demand, and that story is what the massive investment in additional supply was predicated on, well, you know, since that's not panning out particularly, then we've had a massive retrenchment. And any supply that was more than halfway through development will be brought to market, because to abandon it would just mean losing more money. But that it's going to be a very dry environment for anyone trying to raise money for new greenfield sites for the foreseeable future, because prices simply just do not justify that kind of investment. So we're in an abundant commodity or industrial commodity environment. When you look at the soft commodities, and then weather has been, well, not least because there are a lot more people, and therefore there's a lot more demand for crops, and that means that surpluses that have built up over decades have been eroded or wiped out entirely by the surge in demand for foodstuffs and soft commodities over the last decade. And that means then that crops are now much more susceptible to weather damage than they would have been 10 years ago. And this is an El Nino year. So we can anticipate that there is going to be volatility in individual soft commodities. And sugar, for example, has been trending lower for 5 years, and against a background where commodities weren't particularly impressive this week, sugar bounced really rather impressively. And cocoa, despite the fact that they have found the cure for Ebola, has bounced rather impressively from the region of its 200-day moving average. So there are certainly bright spots even within the commodity complex. And even if you look within the mining sector, where the majority of shares are really at quite depressed levels. Well, Norilsk Nickel bounced very impressively last week from the lower side of what is almost a 4-year range. Well, technological innovation is an incredibly important factor, because there are only a small number of sectors that can really change, that can generate incredible value. And those are healthcare, energy, and just technology broadly. Well, technological innovation is accelerating at such a prodigious rate that it's having just a profound effect on the energy and healthcare sectors. It means then that we're going to live longer, healthier lives, and that we'll have the energy to drive economic growth going forward. And this is certainly a period of time where a lot of people are where a lot of people are looking at the market and thinking that it's an uncertain environment. But when we take a step back and we look at the demand growth that is occurring in the consumer sector, the ability of technology not only to transform the productive capacity of millions and even billions of people, but also to transform the productive capacity of corporations, means that when you take that in conjunction with the size of the global middle class and the transformative effect on demand that lower energy prices can have, those are powerfully bullish factors. But they have to be weighed against the distorting effect of quantitative easing. And because you have these two arguments side by side, that could quite easily contribute to ranging. Now that we've seen that the medium-term bull market that was in evidence from 2009 has lost consistency. And if there is no other point that one really needs to look at, that the medium-term bull market that's been in evidence since 2009 has lost consistency. And that means then that the need to be fully invested or to aggressively buy the dips is not as convincing now as it had been all the way through 2012, 13, 14. And if you look at the trend from 2009 onwards, it became progressively more consistent from 2012 to 2015. And that's what we expect, that trends become more consistent as they progress, because people get the message, because people look at history, learn from their mistakes, and say, this is a buy and hold environment. I didn't do very well from trading. If I just bought the dips and held on, I would have done better. And now that that has lost consistency, it suggests that the imbalance between supply and demand that drove the consistency has changed. And therefore, the potential for some ranging, where we really start to answer the big questions. And the big question in this market is, can the very powerful long-term bullish factors overwhelm the distorting influence of quantitative easing as it is slowly but surely unwound? From 2014 onwards, it was just about every central bank in the world was adopting some form of quantitative easing. The Bank of England's balance sheet has been static for 3 years, and the Fed's balance sheet has been mostly static since October of last year. So that incredibly liquid environment that we've been presented with is changing. And then is it any wonder that the environment in stock markets, where you have had this incredible correlation between the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the performance of the S&P 500. Well, the Fed's balance sheet certainly hasn't fallen to the same extent as the S&P recently, but it has most definitely stopped going up. So we could be in a ranging consolidation for a while. But provided that ranging consolidation happens above the long-term range, well, that's a confirmation that we're in a new bull market. It would also allow some of the valuations that have become a little bit racy over the last few years to become a bit more amenable to investors. When I think people start to realize that we are not going to have a financial Armageddon, that this is not a rerun of 2008, and that what's going on in China has been primarily a mishandling of communication, then there is the potential that emerging markets are going to begin to rally once more. And they have had, this has been a particularly difficult environment for emerging markets, and is not over yet. But the value that is being accrued, not least because their currencies are going down so quickly, means that their potential to rally once those currencies stop going down is really quite impressive. So emerging markets haven't been the most fashionable place to be invested for the last year. But looking towards the end of this year and towards 2016, well, it would be very unusual if we didn't see some of the most beaten down asset classes turn into some of the better performers for the subsequent year. And emerging markets have certainly been in that camp. If we do start to think about the eventual normalization of interest rates, then government bonds are really not an attractive asset class. And if you look at the two-year yield over the last 5 years, you're presented with a progression of higher reaction lows over the last 2 years. Now, a lot of people involved in the market will point out how bad the bond market has been at predicting when the first interest rate hike would come. And that's largely irrelevant because we know that an interest rate hike will come eventually, and when it does, those yields are going to break out. And that would suggest a triumph of supply over demand. This isn't particularly good news for the types of companies that have been extremely reliant on access to cheap financing, not least when they come to refinance that debt. And there is a wall of high yield debt needs to be refinanced in the 2019, 2020, 2018-ish region. Then the question is, do you think that the Fed is going to raise rates in September or October or December or March, but rather will interest rates be higher 3 years from now than they are today? Well, if your answer to that is that they will be, then the loss of momentum on the Credit Suisse high yield index, that's for US issues, is potential topping activity. And that this is not a sector that represents particularly good value, that it, more than anything else, represents a momentum trade until we eventually start to see interest rates rising and we approach the environment where in a few years' time we're going to see hundreds of billions of dollars of issues need to be refinanced. And against this background, where the dollar has been so strong against emerging market currencies and mostly ranging against the euro, then gold prices are back at interesting levels, and it is really now for the bulls to prove whether the short-term progression of higher reaction lows is going to hold. From the medium-term perspective, gold is still in a downtrend, and it will need to break its medium-term progression of lower rally highs to really change that prognosis. Well, gold at almost $1,100 is, you know, still really quite a high price relative to where gold has traded historically. And gold shares have retraced a very large percentage of their bull market, and in nominal terms, they're back trading at where they were before the bull market ever got started. All they really need is for gold to stop going down. But if we start to see gold breaking that medium-term progression of lower rally highs, then gold shares represent really deep value at these levels. But I don't think anybody's going to be convinced of that fact until they have evidence that gold prices have found support. And this week, platinum, which had pulled back to the region of the psychological $1,000 level, failed to find support there today. Well, platinum prices found support around 950 early in August, but their inability to hold the $1,000 level isn't really very good news, and that remains really quite a consistent downtrend with relatively equal-sized rallies following the accelerated parts of the decline. And until we see that consistency changed, then this is going to remain a weak price environment. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.